Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. And we are joined by Rick Wilson. Boy, this seems very, very timely, Rick. So let's start off with the news of the day, whether or not we're going to be attacking Iran. The president puts out a tweet saying that he's waiting on a signal from the Saudis. So we're waiting on whether MBS gives him the green light. So first of all, thanks for joining me. What's going on?
Well, look, I think that the tweet last night, whatever time this podcast gets made, but the tweet that Sunday night where Trump said we're waiting for MBS to tell us what to do, I missed that article in the Constitution about where American power to declare war and to take military action was derived. I skipped the part about it being from Saudi Arabia, apparently. But I think, kidding aside, this is a very consequential moment because what we're seeing here is that Iran has a series of perverse incentives to misbehave. And without the JCPOA, which was very flawed in the beginning, but without it, they now have no incentive to behave in the region. And our spectrum of responses is pretty constrained. And our national security apparatus right now, we don't have a national security advisor. Everyone in the government is practically in the national security side as an acting temporary provisional person. So right now we've got the Iranian government looking at Donald Trump, who is basically running a headless operation here on the national security side, and I think that they're going to exploit that to the hilt. And I think that they've called Donald Trump's bluff about maximum pressure, and I think that this is a region where we've had a very bad experience in the last 15 years with asymmetric warfare, and they are masters of that art.
So what, though, are our options? I mean, this is an attack on the global oil supply in Saudi Arabia. This is not something that we can just brush off or look the other way.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. But the problem we've got right now is we've dismantled almost all of our alliances in the region. We have taken apart our ability to call together broad coalitions. There was a broad coalition that was constraining Iran's behavior, and that was the one that was built under the JCPOA, and which, as I said, that's a flawed agreement. It had a lot of problems, but it was having some salutary effects on keeping Iran, in the economic. They had a series of economic incentives not to violate, and so when we took that away, now they're gonna break things until they get us back to the table. And it sounds a lot like Trump is going back to the table, right up until they decided to attack these refineries. But, I think we're in a really tough spot. And, of course, this is a president who doesn't take counsel from his intelligence agencies and doesn't take counsel from the professionals and the military side. You know, he thinks he is the greatest negotiator, and he's going to somehow hand-wave this thing and resolve it. I think we are in a position of significant risk right now, with limited options.
Two quick points there. There was a lot of confusion about whether the president was going to be negotiating with the Iranians. He'd been saying over and over again that there will be no preconditions for a meeting with the Iranian president. Now he's saying that that's completely fake news, even though the record is very clean. Number two, I agree with you. I think the great danger is not whether or not this president is too hawkish or too dovish. The real danger is miscalculation. The unpredictability itself is a risk, and we have that certainly in spades. Okay, so let's look at the other news today. Are we going to have to do Kavanaugh all over again, this Brett Kavanaugh story over the weekend?
God, I watched this Kavanaugh thing emerge this weekend, and all I could think was, dear God, make it stop.
Yeah.
This is not this case as compelling as it seemed in the first wave. Leaving off the one line saying that the witness has no recollection of this matter.
This is bad.
We're back to these reflections of a reflection of a reflection, and here's the thing that I found very cynical about it this weekend is, let's just say this had emerged as a fact. Let's just say that the witness did remember it. It came out. Democratic presidential candidates are out there saying we're going to remove him from the court. Oh, come on! They face the same problem that they face on every other impeachment argument, and that is it's never going to happen with Mitch McConnell in office. and it's probably never going to happen anyway. So what they're doing is taking their base's eye off the ball, which is a competition and a referendum on Donald Trump, and promising them something that isn't going to happen.
That was my reaction as well. And this promising things that will not happen, this is the politics of bullshit that we're in right now, where they convince themselves, well, it's aspirational, by which they mean there's nothing realistic about it. We're going to make promises we can't fulfill. And everybody's supposed to know this, but it was this almost hysterical leap to judgment that we're going to impeach him based on this one story. And it's interesting, the New York Times reviewed this new book and saying in the end, they turn up no smoking gun, no secret confession, no friend who comes forth to say Kavanaugh was lying all this time. But it was this rush to immediately say, you know, we have to have his head. And in terms of just presidential politics, it shows a certain recklessness, but also a gift to Donald Trump, because this is one of those issues that the Republicans did line up around, did rally around the president. And so it seems to hand the president exactly the kind of polarized issue that he would like to have with his base right now.
And Charlie, what is the defining characteristic of the modern Republican Party? It's not fiscal conservatism or limited government or constitutional fealty. It is a rage against the news media. And when the news media makes a mistake like this, it feeds Trump for weeks, and it feeds the sort of Trump media sphere for weeks, and it takes the eye off the ball of a referendum on Donald Trump. One of the other problems with this that I found really just grating was, you know, I see fundraising emails coming out from Democratic candidates about this right away, and I'm like, this is where you guys don't get the game.
Speaking of not getting the game, I want to talk about the pile on Joe Biden, which I find really extraordinary. And the other big gift to the Republicans, I'll see whether you agree, I'm guessing that you do, Beto O'Rourke saying that we in fact are going to come and take your AR-15s and your AK-47s. And I want to play a little audio of that when we come back. First, a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark, BULWARK, ZipRecruiter.com/Bulwark. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. All right, we're back with Rick Wilson. So over the last week, Beto O'Rourke admitted dropping all sorts of F-bombs, which apparently is his ticket. Now, we're not against that. I want to make it clear. We do not judge. But he's also saying that, yes, we are going to confiscate these weapons. Mandatory buyback means mandatory. Now, I think for people who haven't listened to this, the Free Beacon folks have done a fantastic supercut of how this undermines everything that Democrats and liberals have been saying for years. And if you bear with me, let's just play this.
If you own a gun, keep that gun. Nobody wants to take it away from you. At least I don't want to do that.
They think people want to take away their guns.
Nobody wants to take away their guns.
Nobody wants to take away people's guns.
No one's going to take your guns from you.
There's nobody in America has suggested banning any guns.
I do not want to take away any gun rights.
Nobody's taking away anybody's guns.
Nobody is coming to take everybody's guns away.
No one is trying to take away people's guns.
There's nobody who's called for gun reform legislation that's in favor of taking guns away from hunters.
Nobody's trying to take away anybody's guns.
Nobody is interested in taking away guns.
No one wants to take guns from anybody.
No one is trying to take guns away, right?
No one wants to take everyone's guns away.
No one is trying to take your guns away.
No one is trying to take people's guns or seize people's guns.
We're not trying to take your guns.
Nobody's trying to take guns out of the hands of hunters.
It's an interesting thing to respond to. We just want to take away all your guns. Well, actually, that can never happen.
And no one's going to knock down doors to take guns out of houses.
No one is trying to take away your guns.
I'm not here to take away your guns.
No one's trying to take guns away from folks.
No one is trying to take people's guns away.
No one wants to take your guns away.
Absolutely. Nobody's talking about confiscating guns.
No one's looking to take away people's guns.
No one wants to take away guns.
Nobody is talking about confiscating guns.
In 2 years, he's gone from they're going to take your guns away to they're going to take your cows away.
No one's saying take away your guns.
And I think a lot of people that are out there that are fearing what we're saying right now think that we're going to try taking their guns. We're not.
That they jump to the extreme talking point that they're going to come to your door and take all of your guns, which nobody of any credibility in any public policy position has said that is going to happen.
To be clear, they should have them. If you purchase that AR-15, if you own it, keep it. Continue to use it responsibly.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
So, Rick Wilson, over the weekend again, Senator Chris Coons was asked, well, do you support a mandatory buyback, and this is what he had to say.
I am not, and I frankly think that clip will be played for years at Second Amendment rallies with organizations that try to scare people by saying Democrats are coming for your guns.
So what do you think about this? Beto O'Rourke and other Democrats now rushing to go, yes, in fact, we are going to grab your guns.
The fundamental misunderstanding of Democrats on almost every one of the states that's up for grabs in the Electoral College is they are not woke. And they are not woke on a number of areas, but they are really not woke on guns. And Democrats misunderstand this issue deliberately sometimes, you know, out of ignorance of others, but they have convinced themselves that this is their pathway. And Beto O'Rourke, if I were still doing ads on the Republican side, you would never see the end of it.
Yeah.
And you would never see the end of it in states like Florida, where we, and I, as a Floridian who's done more campaigns in Florida than probably any human being alive and operating today, I can tell you something. The Democrats don't even understand their own base in Florida. They don't even understand their own voters. Of the 1.7 million concealed carry permit holders in Florida, about 35% of them are Democrats who live in Democratic counties. Florida loves guns. These people don't ever get it. This is a signifier issue. This is a polarizing issue, and what it is a sign of how badly they underestimate the damage that this does. One of the reasons they lost the House in 1994 wasn't just because of Hillary care. It was because of the assault weapons ban, where people all over this country in places that they thought were safe got blown out because this is an issue. Gun folks and Second Amendment folks will vote on this issue and this issue alone. You can't change their mind on anything else. And a lot of those folks happen to be rural Democrats and happen to be male Democrats. And, you know, if you want to get rid of all your male Democrats in your coalition, well, then good luck. Tell me where you're going to fill that 8-9% back in, because Donald Trump will snap them up. And by the way, the other thing I find super offensive about this is that Beto O'Rourke is a dead man walking. His candidacy is already over. He's not going to be president. He's not going to be dog catcher. Okay? His candidacy is done. It's over. He's never running for Senate in Texas. He's never running for anything meaningful again on a national level. That was a guy trying to throw a long bomb, very cynical politics, and it's not going to work. He's still not even in the top. He's still not even in the top five, much less the top 10.
And what really struck me is this is one of these, it sort of has a Trumpian flavor to it. You're supposed to take it seriously, but not literally, because, you know, one in
right.
five firearms sold in this country is AR-15. There's 15 million of them out there. So this is not a serious proposal. But the whole point is, it's like virtue signaling, right? It's not a realistic proposal. It's sort of ideological self-pleasuring. It's supposed to signal purity of heart and fervor of intention. I thought it was interesting over the weekend. He went on, I think it was the Joy Reid show. And it was asked, well, how are you going to enforce this? And he basically says, oh, people are just going to voluntarily comply with all of this. I mean, that gives naivete a bad name.
Yeah, the pure hand wavium on that of like, you know, and you know, Democrats who are freaking out that Trump is building a police state fascist empire, basically are going to say, okay, well, what we're going to do is have a mandatory national program where everyone has to turn in their weapons, or they're going to be felons, and we're going to come and arrest them and take the guns away. Good luck with that. You know, and I'm not doing that like that dick waving super macho guy, come to my house, I'll shoot you. No, I'm just saying there will be what happened in Massachusetts and in New York when they had a mandatory, you know, thing. They just, the massive noncompliance is what happens.
And this feels like the same old debate, because who would not comply with this? Well, the bad guys.
Right.
People who want to go on mass shootings or commit crimes are not going to come forward and sell their guns back. So almost by definition, the people who will comply with this law are law-abiding citizens. This will not take a single gun out of the hands of a single potential mass killer. But again, that's not the point. It does feel Trumpian. It does feel like the, I'm going to deport all 12 million illegal immigrants. You're not going to do that, but it signals your purity. Or I'm going to build the wall and have the Mexicans pay for it. And you just know, listening to Beto O'Rourke, that he hasn't thought this through. He hasn't internalized it. Waving his hand to this. But the damage it will do to the Democrats, and the way that it flips an issue that I think they were poised to win on into a loser, is dramatic, because I think most people in this country right now do support reasonable common sense gun control. But now he has just handed this weapon to the Trump folks and to the GOP.
He's turned it into a single extremist proposal that he's basing it on. And look, I've seen this. I followed this particular set of polling for a very long time. And when there's a mass shooting or when there's an incident, there's a surge in the number that says, oh, we need to do universal background checks. We need to do, you know, ban on semi-autos, ban on this, ban on that. Well, and that number always fades away. And even when these things happen, in the most important problems that decide elections, that people actually go out and vote on, gun control is never, ever on the side of the Democrats. Every time this gun control becomes an issue, it benefits the Republicans. It has universally been the case. There's never been a big statewide race where the Democrat, in a purple state, where the Democrat was able to say, I'm going to run on gun control. I'm going to run against, you know, assault weapons and make it work. It's just not going to be there. And as much as Democrats want to think that this is their moment on it, and to you know, play the Sharon Watts game, they really underestimate the depth to which guns are embedded in the culture, and not in a negative way. They underestimate even the fact that their own base, you know, I don't know if those numbers replicate out beyond Florida, because in Florida, what I did was I took the voter file and I took the concealed carry permit registration data and we merged them and we figured out, you know, here's this giant number, 1.7 million people with a concealed carry permit in Florida, and the largest gun owning per capita population in the country in Florida, not Texas, Florida. And they don't get it. They don't understand it. And their idea that, oh, we're going to ban semi-automatic weapons, and we're going to ban this, and we're going to ban that, we're going to close off this, it is not, as you said, going to cause one iota of less crime. And it is one more of these promises that they think sounds great when they're in a progressive primary, and that is absolutely electoral poison when they get to the general election.
You know, it does strike me that the progressives are in a bubble, but they don't know that they're in a bubble. They actually don't imagine it. And what bubbles do is they reinforce the crazy. They silence the voice of the person in the sign saying, by the way, you know, this is going to backfire on you. And so they keep saying words like big and bold, when in fact, big and bold turns out to be extreme and unpopular. And I don't know where this goes.
Charlie, here's the thing. It's like they started out their debate on healthcare this year, like, and everybody was going to, like, I'm going to fix Obamacare. And then it became, I'm going to do Medicare for all. And then it became, I'm going to kill off all private insurance, so you must go on a government healthcare plan. I mean, and they think that this is like what people want. And, you know, maybe that's what Chapo Trap House guys want. Maybe that's what you know, the woke edge of the woke edge wants. But it's not what the mainstream of American political thought is. It's not what voters in the 15 swing states that are actually up for grabs this time are going to find palatable. And I think the health insurance thing, you know, suburban parents who are skeptical of Trump are not looking for a counter-revolution. They're looking for a restoration of normality. And that is where I think a lot of the Democrats who are flailing don't understand, and say things like what Beto just did, they don't understand it. You know, they're not looking for a countervailing edge case to Trump. They're looking for a return to something in the sort of political homeostasis that we had for generations.
So let's talk about Joe Biden and the pile-on over the last week. Now, last week, it feels like a million years ago, there was a poll, I think, showing Biden beating Trump by 16 points nationally. I thought he turned in a strong performance, at least at the beginning of the debate. But there are actually people who are writing columns now saying that he should drop out of the race because of all of these doubts about how old he is and whether he's up for it. At a certain point, that narrative seems like it's folding back on itself, and it's become a thing. So, what is your take on all of this? The one guy who I think has the best shot, at least at the moment, of taking down Donald Trump appears to be in the sights of both the left wing of the party and the dominant media narrative at the moment.
Look, piling on Joe Biden is America's favorite pastime right now, and this there's a little bit of desperation in the air among the B tier candidates. Okay, you know, Warren and Bernie are in this sort of titanic sumo wrestling match of progressives, and one of them is going to win, and that person is desperate to, you know, that person is desperate to take out whoever that person has to take out of Joe Biden to get him out of the way. And All the lower tier candidates, the Harrises and the Bookers and the Yang, all the other cats and dogs, they are equally eager to try to take Joe Biden down and be the guy who did that. So they are elevated into the higher tier. I mean, that's why Julian Castro engaged in that very ugly moment in the debate the other night. It didn't work for him, you know, by the way. It blew back on him. And from what I understand, his candidacy is, you know, this was a guy who was running to be VP. And, I think he probably blew that chance, in the last debate. So
what is your take though on Joe Biden? Because
I wish Joe Biden was 10 years younger and a little bit sharper, but here's the thing. Name ID in politics is one of the deepest forms of magic, and name ID papers over a whole lot of other horseshit. Joe Biden is known. He is a brand that is established with voters in the country. This may not be the brand that the wokest of the woke enjoy, and it may not be the brand that the media wants to see as a fresh young face, but he is still the giant to be killed in the Democratic primary field, and he needs to basically go in and sustain one more good debate in October, and I think he can shake a lot of this off. But, you know, it is going to be a real challenge. He's going to have to really kill it in South Carolina, because Elizabeth Warren looks like she's very well organized and very dominant in Iowa right now, doing well in Iowa. Bernie Sanders is a neighbor to New Hampshire, and in the Democratic primary in New Hampshire, there is a certain degree of kooky socialism that likes that Bernie flavor. I just actually read some focus groups out of New Hampshire the other day. Among Democrats, and even though they admitted, they're like, oh, we know Bernie will lose to Trump, but, you know, we just love him because, you know, he's the pure one, which I find a perfect encapsulation of the Democratic Party's politics.
Yeah, you said before that you think that Bernie would lose 44 states.
I think Bernie would lose 44 states. I think if you put Bernie on the ticket, the Republicans would even have a chance to pick up Washington State. That's how crazy Bernie is, and that's how badly he will do in a national election.
What about Elizabeth Warren? Is she elect? Can she beat Trump?
This is a matter of which I, as a longtime operator and political observer and pollster and everything else, I question every day. I don't believe policy ever wins elections. And if the elections were based on policy, you know, she's got depth and she's got granularity and she's got smarts, but, you know, they're not. They're based on personality. And I just wonder if the sort of academic school marmy thing, you know, if we didn't try that already with Hillary. And I wonder about it. I don't know the answer, Charlie. I wish I could tell you definitively yes or no.
She does come off with that high school vice principal vibe. that I just
a little bit. Yeah. And I mean, you know, the fighting for working people thing, it feels a little strained. You know, it doesn't feel like, it feels like now you will have this rhetoric class and we will teach you how to present and you will make these emotive gestures and you will speak from the diaphragm. And it just doesn't, there's some about it that I just don't quite buy into, that I just don't quite love. But, you know, she is running, technically speaking, a good campaign. She's running a well-organized campaign. She's doing the work on the ground in Iowa, and that counts.
Rick Wilson, I know you have to catch a plane, so I don't want to keep you, and I want you to fly safely. And again, thanks so much for joining us on the Bulwark Podcast on this Monday.
You bet, Charlie. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by our friends at ZipRecruiter. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.